Everyone, thank you for taking the time and lending your ears to these various conversations. Very excited to share all the guests that I have with you this season. And in order for this season to be a success, I need you guys to help share the word and spread the love of the What Makes You Tick pod. While you're listening, please take a moment to like or subscribe to the podcast wherever you are. And as always, I really appreciate all the help and the support that you guys have given me.
It's very humbling that you can go and do a challenge like that, right? And I remember after the IRC crossing, I got into bed at like half 11, 12 o'clock at night. And even with my eyes closed, I was still swaying like I was on the water.
You had the sea legs. Still, okay.
Yeah. I couldn't sleep. I was in that much pain. And I came down like 5 a.m. I was lying on the sitting room floor trying to stretch things out, ease things out. And when I got up like properly the next morning and my son Dylan was up, I can't even lift my child up. So Sarah Jane was saying, it's like, just relax today. I was like, no, I was like, I'm going to work, because if I stay here, I can't even hang out with him properly. So like, I prefer to go into work and type because I don't have to lift my arms a whole lot than stay here and know that I can't kind of commit to playing with him properly.
Damien Wiles, welcome to What Makes You Tick. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a super, super guest joining me on this episode. We have been trying for ages to do this in person. And unfortunately, between timings and everything, we're back to the Zoom video. But no doubt this will be still a real impressive podcast. Damien, welcome on board. How are you, pal?
Well, good. Thanks, Lee. How are you?
Good. Yeah, good, good, good. I've been running around the place there. I just came from the National Rehabilitation Hospital, where one of my recent guests, Fergus Gussie Farrell, he literally ran from Athenry to the National Rehabilitation Hospital in 4 days, and he covered 508 kilometers, which is insane. And like, this guy couldn't walk. He was given a 5% chance to walk 5 years ago, and now he's running across the bloody country. I couldn't walk from here run from here to the end of my road.
Yeah, that's a serious drive. Yeah, and you know what? It's not a nice time of year to do that either, because you're not going to guarantee the sunshine, you're never guaranteed sunshine, but you're not getting that warm weather, and the light closing in on you as well.
Well, he said the first 2 days he just got drenched, and they had to change his runners and everything. And with about 15 kilometers to go, something kind of gave in his leg. He finished it, you know, and he could barely walk coming across it, but absolute legend. But so just come from there, and now I'm here with you, and it's gas, because when I met Fergus, it was when Damien Brown was doing his adventure and they were trying to attempt to row across the Atlantic. And it kind of actually is a nice little segue to why you're here, because from one adventure to another, you would, I suppose, describe yourself as an adventure athlete, right? And I think that's quite fitting. Maybe it would be good to give people a bit of a sense of what type of adventures you actually put yourself, your body, your mind, and everything through. Because like, when you reached out to me a few months back and your message was super compelling, I was like, I got to get this guy on the pod. So yeah, maybe give people a bit of an insight into what you do and why you are one of the great adventurers of Irish sport.
Well, I suppose as a baseline, I enjoy a bit of suffering. So played rugby for a long time, transitioned out of that, kind of moved into open water swimming. Would have been doing distances up to maybe 10K. Got coaxed into doing a few Ironman, but I never liked cycling or running. But being in the water was always my big kind of passion. Just love being in the water. Particularly surfing and swimming. Before COVID, or just during COVID, I had my first child. And at that time, I had to make a decision about kind of what I was going to train for. And I wanted to make sure if I was going to spend time doing something, if I was going to be away from him, that I wanted to make sure I really enjoyed doing it. So I wasn't kind of feeling bad about being away and doing something that I didn't really enjoy, which led to prone paddleboarding. Which isn't very common. So prone paddleboarding is basically a lie down version of stand up paddleboarding. You paddle, propel yourself using your hands. And initially, the intention was to get to Hawaii to the World Championships or get over to the Catalina Classic in California. With COVID, travel wasn't happening. But we're an island. We're surrounded by water. So I was like, look, there has to be stuff here that we can do. And over the last couple of years now, in 2021, would have become the first person to circumnavigate Achill Island, 65K, and it's about 9.5 hours paddling. But you're through very, very remote waters, no phone signal, very isolated. Then that was all in preparation for what ended up being a 2-year plan to prone paddleboard across the Irish Sea from Holyhead back to Greystone. So that was 100 kilometers in just under 15 hours. And in June of this year, I was under a little bit more time pressure this year than I had been, but I still wanted to do something. So we came up with a challenge to swim, well, try to swim 1 kilometer in every county over one weekend. So that was 32 1 kilometer swims kind of back to back, starting on a Friday at 4:30 in the morning, finishing, I think, at 5:00 in the evening, then in Greystones. So that's, I suppose, a snapshot of what I've been coming up with.
There is so much to unpack there, right? There's so much. Like, first of all, what is your reasoning for doing this? Like, you talk about prone paddle boarding, right? But it's extreme prone paddle boarding. Like, what I'm talking about here is like prone paddle boarding or whatever, going out in your board and paddling away and having a crack. Great, lovely. But like 9 hours, like, it's super extreme. Like, your body must go through awful torture. Like, why did you and how did you decide that this was going to be the thing for you?
Well, I suppose in terms of the sport itself and just kind of getting involved, I'm really lucky that from a young age, I've been involved in the water. With photos up at home of us out on a rib at kind of like 3-4 months old, off the Atlantic coastline. My parents would have been dive masters, so they would have been spending time scuba diving. And even like ages 3, 4, 5, you're in a wetsuit and you're jumping off a boat into water you can't even see the bottom from the top of, just trying to spot the bubbles from where the scuba divers are. And that, I suppose, that led into me kind of taking up surfing. And it was always kind of a summer-based sport. And as I got older, and as even while rugby was there and as it faded off, I was always just itching to get back. And once you hit kind of 18, 19, you have a car, you have to get driving, and all of a sudden I had surfing was bringing me on my J1 to Hawaii for 3 months, Australia for the guts of a year, Sri Lanka, Canaries, UK, France. So it's very lucky that it's kind of brought me all over the world. There's been a reason to go traveling. And through those travels, I kind of got exposed to a couple of different disciplines, and prone paddling was one of them. But I never saw it in Ireland. There is some of the surf lifesavers would use it on rescue boards, but not, this is kind of a, I suppose, another avenue of this discipline. And the more I looked into it and the more I found out about it, it was always on the periphery, but it really took until my hand was forced to make a decision on what I was going to do. And I was like, look, I just love being in the water. So what's the go between surfing and swimming, prone paddleboarding? So I just took a chance. Unfortunately, it worked out. And the progression from there is I grew up in Greystones and would have sailed a lot as a kid. And my secondary school was right down on the coast, right beside the sea. And I remember when I was younger, looking out the back of the classroom, sitting in the back class, looking out the window on these crap days or really nice days, just looking at the water. Then from going to college, I get the bus from the top of a hill. And on these kind of mornings, kind of October, September, October, you could see whales. And there's always something in the back of my head. It's like, Jesus, like, how far away is it really if we can actually see these silhouettes? And it was like the first thing that came to my mind. And I'd probably class it as, I have a bit of a relentless streak in me that if I see something that kind of fires me up, I'm all in. And from that point, once I saw that, Like, I didn't really care what the distance was. If it was 200K, I was still going after it. And that was kind of where that one started from. And yeah, it was kind of a natural progression from there with COVID and all. We couldn't get that crossing done. That led to ACL. And I'd spent a lot of time in ACL during summers when I was younger. I'd say I've probably been to ACL for a week or two every year since I was born.
Great spot.
Fantastic, yeah.
Good.
With prone paddling, same with kind of paddling as well in general. I suppose the aspect that you view the land from is so entirely different. Most of the time we spend our time looking from land out to sea.
Hmm.
Now you're on a board, you're spending time from sea looking back to land. And with the Irish Sea, one of the big things was I was itching to just feel that isolation. When I say isolation, I had an escort boat. Not entirely isolated, but of being in the middle of a huge expanse of water and just seeing what that felt like.
What did it feel like?
Incredible. I think it's very humbling to realize how insignificant you are. That when you're in the middle, like regardless of how much you're suffering or how many jellyfish things you have, like you're in the middle of a body of water that if it turns or the weather changes, you're in trouble and there's very little that you can do about it. Now that sounds like there was a lot of risk being taken. I'd been scanning weather charts for weeks. We knew it was pretty much good to go.
Yeah, you're doing all the safety checks beforehand and like you're not being irresponsible. Like you're not just going, here, listen, let's go out this evening and we'll see what happens and how far we can go. Like, yeah, there's plenty of planning that goes with it.
I wish it was that easy. It was an absolute saga. We went to attempt it. And when you're lining up something like this, say if you sign up for a race, 5K, 10K, anything up to an Ironman, you know the start date, the start time, you know where the start line is, you know where the finish line is, and you know what you have to get through to get it done. With something like this, due to the expanse of water that you're looking to cover, if the wind is the wrong direction, it isn't viable. If the wind is going to come up during the day, it's not viable. If it's too still, there's a potential for fog to come in and mess the whole thing up. You're dealing with shipping lanes. You're dealing with errors of light. You're trying to get competent boat captains to ferry you across. And I suppose this aspect of your kind of preparation is where you start looking at your controllables versus uncontrollables. There's a large portion of these that you can actively prepare for. So you can get all your training done. You can get your nutrition in. You can get your boat ready. You can understand your route. But there are variables there that you have no control over. So is the weather going to change? What's the tide going to do? Are you going to have any malfunctions on the day? And while you can maybe mentally prepare for some of those things, you don't really have any control. So you're trying not to spend any time invested in those specifically. And it's very taxing because I would say from the minute that I thought of this as a concept, I'd say I spent at least, when I say 2 hours, I don't mean sitting down for 2 hours. I mean like every 10 minutes, this coming into your head for like 10, 15 seconds at a time, just thinking, what if, what if, what if? Going over plans, contingencies, nutrition, training. And because you're developing it all, you're entirely reliant on your own decision making. So now you have the double-edged sword of, I can put in the training, but if I make the wrong decision, I've balls it up for myself. And so where the two of those combine, we had an attempt in kind of mid-July of 2022. We get 6K offshore, smoke starts appearing from the rear of the boat, and we have to turn around and go back. And that was meant to be we were sailing across to come back. And that was probably one of the worst days of my life. I'd been lining this thing up and I was so stoked and amped to get going. Weather was absolutely perfect. And then all of a sudden, like that, a variable I had no control over.
And so you were attempting to cross from Ireland over to England, is it?
We were sailing the escort boat over to come back again. So we were on the way over. And this was just in preparation for the next day.
Okay.
So huge mental hit. And I remember coming back and I came back to the house and Sarah Jane, my wife, was here. And she said, I'm leaving the house for a while because you need a bit of room. So she headed off for a bit. And
what a good teammate. What a good partner.
Yes,
what a good partner.
Absolutely.
Like, know your
fair,
audience.
I probably should have been told to leave. And I remember I got to a point where I was like, right, there's two options here. It's like, you shit or get off the pot. So you either keep chasing or you decide that it's all a lost cause. And I remember the next morning, I was up scouring the internet trying to find someone that would actually skipper a boat over in the next couple of weeks. Unfortunately, came across a gentleman called Vincent from Oceans Ireland. And within kind of 6 weeks, we'd identified it at the tide window, the weather window. We'd had a meeting a month before and we were staying in touch. And all of a sudden it was go time. But go time doesn't mean that things are, the organization is finished. Now you're on to booking ferries, booking your accommodation, sorting your meals, getting all your gear kind of prepped and ready to go,
yeah.
Getting into Dunleary to drop it off. So if anything, it kind of accelerates the intensity. And that whole time, all you're thinking is just get me to the water. And even up until that time, is the escort boat going to get here? Even then, silly things like, what if I eat something that gives me food poisoning? Like, so
let's let's pull it back a little bit here now, because there's so many things you're thinking of, right? So what's the ultimate goal of this adventure addiction that you have? Like, what are you trying to achieve? Because you've circumnavigated Achill Island, the first person to do that, right? Box ticked. You're number one. Nobody can ever take that away from you, right?
Yeah.
You've tried your Ironmans and your hat and your triathlons and all that stuff. And while that's massive challenges and kudos to anybody who does that, just doesn't tickle your fancy, right? Now you're doing this crossing. Like, what's next? You know, you've done the 32 counties, you know, like what's the driving force behind all these challenges in your own head?
So I'd say there's two different avenues. On the adventure side of things, I just think we live in a fantastic country. Like, I'm fortunate to have traveled, not as much as a lot of people, but traveled a bit and to get exposed to kind of surf cultures and gone to places where I probably as a kid would have dreamed of going anyway. But any time I was there, I love being home, love being in Ireland, everything about it, from childhood holidays, which were like 6 weeks camping over west and spending time in the water. It was probably an extension of that kind of scene where else I could go and what else you could see. So after doing Achill, then you have the largest body of water, apart from the Atlantic, obviously, being the Irish Sea. And so it just kind of evolves that way. On the other side of it, though, from the physical side, I suppose I kind of found that I had a bit of a capacity to suffer and to kind of put myself in a dark place and to push through to get to the opposite side. And I enjoy exploring that aspect. I know a lot of people kind of hear that and they think that it's just like this whole thing of masochism where you're just looking to suffer for the sake of suffering. But I think I'm incredibly lucky. I've two arms, I've two legs, I'm healthy, I'm fit, and I've been provided with every opportunity that you can have to go and play sports and kick a ball and run around with friends. And I kind of look around, you see there's kids that are born and they're in wheelchairs straight away. You get people that suffer from illness or injury that end up being incapacitated, whether that's through paralysis or even just having bad injuries long-term that kind of limit their ability to do more. And I just think it's such a shame that people don't pursue testing themselves in this capacity. I don't mean to the extent of crossing the IRC, if it's a 5K run, 10K run, cycle, whatever it is, but just testing your body to see what you're capable of doing. I think it's hugely rewarding. And for me, I think I've probably gained a lot from it. to come from a team sport background to kind of gradually move across into something where you're just entirely self-sufficient and doing it by yourself, I've had huge kind of, I'd probably call them mental gains in terms of
yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because like what I just wrote down here, like what have you learned from suffering, you know, because we can all suffer in different ways, right? Some people suffer mentally and they get depressed and they have psychological suffering. Others have physical suffering, as you said, with challenges of not being able to walk properly or not being able to do things that typically people who have no injuries take for granted. Like, what goes through your mind when you're in that moment of suffering, or what do you look forward to?
So before I take on anything like this, there's a huge acceptance of the fact that you're going to suffer. So I go into these things being well aware of the fact that at some stage I am going to slump pretty badly. And so the first thing that goes through my head when I start suffering is, this is where you wanted to be. And this is where you wanted to get to. And this is now where the test starts. Before that suffering kicked in, there wasn't really a challenge there because you're working within your abilities. But once that suffering starts or the testing starts, that's where all of a sudden you start seeing how your mental resolve is going to react. And I think that's probably where mentally I would be at my strongest in terms of these events. And what I've learned from it is that whatever I've gone through to date hasn't been enough to make me cave, so I know there's more. And I think that's a huge confidence builder. And again, I think this can be applied to any size challenge. Like, there's, for the most part, there's nothing unique about my physical capacity. I think most people who have two arms and two legs have the ability to take up what I'm doing. And if you spend enough time at it, you're probably going to be able to develop the fitness to get there. But I think in a lot of cases, it's having the capacity to make the decision to then push yourself on to that next step. And I think that's maybe where there's a point of difference. We're all wired differently.
Yeah. I think when you talk about suffering there as well, I think the suffering or the kind of the desire for that kind of part of your brain to kick in to go, oh, listen, just step away now. You know, don't worry. Nobody's looking, you know, nobody will mind. Everybody is going to pat you on the back because, like, at least you gave it an effort. You know, you don't need to do this. Who are you proving it to? And I think that's that kind of part of our mindset kicks in for everybody at different moments and different stages. So if you're trying to go from a couch to 5K, that could start in the first kind of getting up off the couch. Don't worry, start tomorrow, you know? Once you get that movement, or once you get that kind of the first step, which is, I find, the hardest one, but once you get that first step and you go out and you do that run or that walk or that try that paddle, prone paddling, then all of a sudden, then you release these endorphins. You find to be proud of yourself in a certain way for doing it. It makes you want to come back to do it again. All of a sudden you go the next day, then you've got momentum. And then all of a sudden you're getting into this habit of, like, to your point, you're testing yourself to that point. What's my limit?
Yeah. You know?
And what do you think your limit is?
I'm not entirely sure. So in terms of kind of volume or distances or whatever, I'd have to go and test that, and I'm hoping to do that over the next couple of years and keep pushing on. But I think everybody's mental resolve is different. So say, for example, the special forces that we see people signing up to. I've had a couple of people that have said to me, oh, you should go on that. And of all people, the one person that's been at every challenge that I've done has been my dad. He's been there to own because he knows what I can handle, and if something slumped, he's the one person who I always say that if I'm doing something, he has the ability to overrule any decision I'm making and call it and say that I'm not continuing. He's the only person I think I've come across that said to me, you couldn't do that. And he's right, because I wouldn't be able to suffer in that way, having someone kind of berate me over and over and over again. Other people do. So you kind of, I think the kind of mental strength that people develop varies depending on what we're doing or what we're pursuing. And for me, I think the metrics by which people kind of measure their ability and their resolve, in some ways, while they're quite broad, they've been very narrowed by kind of modern society, because I think people look at running, whether it is, like you said, a couch to 5K or half marathon, or the likes of the Ironman. And I think all of a sudden now people feel that they need to get to a start line and get to a finish line in order to test themselves and to be in some way successful in their own head.
Yeah.
But I think there is so much opportunity out there to test yourself on your own terms and kind of define success within your own head and see how that works. And I think that opens up the opportunity to find a proper passion about something, which is far more of a driver than a medal will ever be.
It's funny, you remind me of Ross Edgley. You know Ross Edgley?
Yeah.
And recently he attempted to, and it was, I think, his second attempt to complete the world's longest continuous leg swim, right?
Yeah.
And you talk about suffering, right? And testing yourself. Like, from all accounts, I believe his tongue started to deteriorate because there was so much salt on his tongue that it ended up started to dissolving. Like, they had to pull him away and to get him out of the water because there was a heat wave, and I think he got heat stroke in the water and something. Like, it was just insane stuff, right? Yeah. So, like, and obviously he's been doing that type of thing for years and years and years and years. Like, it gets to a point when your curiosity, I think, of that limit, because we all have limits, but it's, I think when when I spoke to Damian Brown, he was saying that it's in every, all those dark, dark moments when his body is completely shagged, it's when he figures out something new about himself.
Yeah.
Do you find that as well? Do you find yourself in that kind of state of growth when you are at a point where, like, I don't know how we can continue?
Yeah. So during the Irish Sea crossing, like, I'd been training for 2 years, because there was a whole kind of process building up to it. Nutrition was dialed, hydration was dialed. I had my feed plan, had my hydration plan, knew exactly how I wanted the day to be structured, knew the paces I wanted to hit, had been trialing food. So every bit that I could have controlled, I had in place. So there was no stone unturned. And it comes to the day, and weather is fantastic. It worked out perfectly. We get into the water at Holyhead, start paddling, and there's a huge sense of relief, because all of a sudden you're where you wanted to be for 2 years, but there's also a lot of anticipation, because you're saying, yeah, but you're going to suffer like a dog.
How long is this supposed to take you?
I had estimated between 14 and 16 hours, and it took just under 15. I was slightly on the quicker side of what I was expecting.
Okay, so sorry for interrupting, but go ahead. Fine. Yeah.
And you're in your head, then you kind of get into a rhythm, and you can't kind of say, okay, well, things aren't going to go wrong. I reckon until it was about over 65K, because I was the ACL paddle, and ACL was okay-ish. I suffered badly, but I reckon I had the fitness level to kind of bring me beyond that. 25K in, my wash blows. I have no way of telling what way my pace is going. So straight away, you have that mental struggle of, what am I doing now? I don't know what pace I'm at. But you have to shrug your shoulder and say, well, what are you going to do? Like, there's no one here that can fix a Garmin, and you can't do it. So just sack it in and get on with it. So you spend maybe an hour and a half of your time thinking about how pissed off you are with Garmin as a company. And then that distracts you. And my dad shouting at my splits, he had a watch. kind of letting me know where things were. But then I get to 30K and my stomach turned. Couldn't eat, couldn't drink. So now my feed plan and my hydration plan is out the window. And over that length of time, it's very risky, but I made the call, I'm not going to eat.
Okay, so just give people a bit of context there, because you're swimming now and you're talking about eating. So you're paddling now and you're talking about eating. So
yeah, so I have on the board, it's like a really big surfboard. It's 14 foot long, but it'd be like the hull of a boat. It's quite rounded, and there's a dish in the middle that you lie into that kind of has a foam padding on it that you can lie on or put your knees on. And in front of me, I have a bottle rack. Two bottles in there, and Percy Pigs, sure, fantastic. So eating Percy Pigs, and I had a carbohydrate drink that's kind of, I was trying to take in something like 90 grams of carbs, which is very difficult to do even when you're moving. Because in these endurance things, you're basically, it's like a sandbag where you're trying to just limit that. You're trying to limit the amount that you're burning by topping up, but you can never top up at the same rate you're burning. So you're trying to get like your 90 grams in, but you can only maybe, I think like the top athletes in the world can maybe process above that. I'd probably be somewhere around maybe 75 grams an hour is what I could process, but you're hoping by kind of getting it in that you're going to keep moving yourself along. And what I do is, it was every hour, it was to paddle over to the boat and grab, it was brioche Nutella and half banana. So you're eating like a king on these things.
I love it. Like this nutrition, yeah. Absolute brilliant. Masterclass.
So you're just grab that, swap a bottle, and you're just eating as you're paddling and keep going. And yeah, I think it's maybe 4 hours in, all of a sudden stomach just says, nope, not interested anymore. Just felt shit, just awful. Didn't feel like I was going to throw up, but my stomach wasn't settled. Even drinking, I just not feeling right. So I was like, right, not eating. I'll drink as I feel like I should. But it was a hot day. Like it was probably about 24 degrees on the water, flat, calm, super glassy, and blaring sunshine. So like it was as tropical as you could hope to get on the Irish Sea.
Yeah.
And it took until 50K before my stomach started to settle. And at that stage then, I had been eating a few bits and pieces, and I just said, look, just give me like a savory Sambo. And it always sounds funny because you're on salt water, so why do you want salt? But having something savory to get away from the sweetness of the carbohydrate drinks and all, just, it can kind of sometimes help. So had a Sambo and like a handful of Doritos, which again, they sound so simple, taste fantastic. And at that stage, we were that isolated that there was a seagull that had been following me for about 20K. And every time he swooped past me, I could smell him. He stank, absolutely reeked.
Yeah.
And then he ended up disappearing. But the whole time now, you have been suffering kind of mentally, but physically, apart from the eating, you're doing okay. After the 50K, everything kind of came back around. You're like, right, we've got to the watch. We've got through the bad spell of the eating. So now things are running quite smooth. And all of a sudden, the boat captain said, swing south. So I had to turn the nose of the board all the way south. And while I had been looking at, like, the Wicklow Mountains were getting bigger and closer, all of a sudden I wasn't looking at land anymore. And Lee was the skipper's name, fantastic skipper. And I said, look, I said, get Lee out to me. I was like, I need to talk to someone here. And Lee came up and I said, look, I'm not telling you that I want to change. I said, but someone tell me what the fuck is going on.
Why am I pointing this way? Yeah. The currents were all over the shop, were they?
Yeah, exactly. So we had to turn the nose into the current to offset it and make sure you're making some ground. And around an hour after that happened, and bear in mind now, you spent time traveling in a direction where you think you're going good. And then all of a sudden the nose swings, you're not looking at land. It's a bit of a mental hit. Because you just don't feel like you're going the right direction. Then all of a sudden, my shoulders just blew up on like 75K. I could feel them starting to come under pressure. And my scapula, my shoulders, my chest just felt absolutely wiped.
So you're how many hours in at this stage now? You're up to 55, 60K, is it?
Yeah, I was probably, sorry, about 70, 75K.
70, so 70. And you're literally, so when you talk about your shoulders killing you, it's because you're essentially like front crawling on a paddle board all the way across for the last whatever number of hours.
Yeah.
Constant.
Exactly. Yeah. Like we, I think for that lunch break, like I think I stopped for like 7 minutes, but I didn't, like, that wasn't getting off the board. That was just grub and hammer and
refueling and going again. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we get to this point, my shoulders blow up. And so the first thing was, this is where you wanted to be. You've had these couple of tests. And so now
we're really suffering.
This is, and like 25K on the paddleboard is going to be like 3.5 to 4 hours. About four or four and a half hours. So you start doing the maths in your head, because even though the boat was there was times where I was like 100 meters to one side of them. So you're by yourself. And I was thinking, Jesus, like 75K in, 25K to go, shoulders feel absolutely jacked. And then you're like, then your head starts firing. So you're like, right, I'm that close that I've been envisioning myself passing between the two pillars in the Grey Sons Marina for the last 2 years. I'm not letting that slip. So then you start thinking of what way are you going to manage this now to get yourself over. So first thing was painkillers, to kind of settle things down. And then was to start getting in small doses of caffeine, just to kind of fire, but make sure you didn't have a huge slump after. But at that rate now, the light is going down, so you know it's going to start getting dark. You're probably getting a bit cold. I jellyfish things on my hands and on my wrists. I could feel sunburn on my back, on my neck. My chest was rubbing underneath my arms. It was all chafed to bits, like it was properly raw. So you're in the absolute pits of it. And I remember paddling along and I was thinking, I'm in a fucking heap here and I'm going to be really bad for I don't know how long after this. And I remember looking up at my dad, and I just said to him, I started laughing, and I said, I am absolutely fucked here. And my dad just looked at me and said, yeah, well, you signed up for this. Okay, you're right.
Love it. Go on, dad. Talk about, that's exactly what you needed to hear.
Yeah.
I'm sure, like, Jesus Christ, because, like, there's nobody feeling sorry for you out there in the middle of the ocean. Like,
No, not at all. So I suppose from my end, when I get to that point, you kind of lock into a business mode. I don't necessarily see the darkest patches of these events being where you kind of wallow in the suffering. You're aware you're suffering, but your mind kind of switches to say, right, how are you going to manage yourself and your time to make sure you get through this? Because it is going to alleviate. It can't go on forever.
There is an end.
The end point is the finish line, or if your body comes round again, it is going to end, but you just have to have the resolve to say you're going to keep pushing on. And I suppose in terms of growth, you were saying, or asking about that, it's those times, I think, where you kind of develop, because you start to appreciate your ability to make smart decisions in tough situations. And once you start learning how to adapt to that, the darker periods start to become a little bit more manageable, because you start managing your head in a way where you're saying, okay, there's no point focusing on the pain and the discomfort, because even if I'm in great form, that's still going to be there. So let's just deviate from that, manage it, but then make sure you focus on how you're drawing yourself through it. And I found then that's where I suppose you have the kind of real world application, where things do come under pressure, or someone's pushing you for something, or whatever it is, that gives you the ability to kind of take a breath and say, right, this is where we're going to go.
What do you like with failure?
Not great. Even when I was young, rugby would have gone quite well for me. Up until under 20s, and when I realized that I kind of missed the boat on it going the professional route, and I kind of got a letter or a phone call of rejection for going academy route and all that sort of crack, I devastated, absolutely devastated. And I would say that was probably, I probably didn't manage that very well. Now looking back at what I know now,
what did you do? Like what did you do that you didn't manage well? Like,
oh, it's just being a miserable sod for like 2 weeks, just pissed off and kind of thinking, oh, this is the end of the world. What am I ever going to do? Because look, I know you're from a rural background as well, and I think there's so much of you when you're younger is made up of what other people see you succeeding at. And when I was younger, what a lot of people would have known me for was rugby. And that was it. So all of a sudden, when that's taken away, you're thinking, Jesus, what am I doing here? I'm after spending all this time. But then a couple of weeks pass, and I remember being up in the gym in Greystones. And I was doing some big plyometrics exercises, and I was like, what am I doing here? Like, no one's going to hit me. I don't have to hit anybody. And this is serving no purpose other than saying big. And I remember looking back out of the pool, and for all the time I wanted to spend surfing, and I'd spent a lot of time swimming as a kid, it hadn't kind of clicked to get in. And then all of a sudden I was like, right, pool. So the next evening I was down. I was like, oh, I'm going to try and do a kilometer, four lengths in, just gassed. And I was like, so here we are. We now have something that I can focus on, where I don't have to talk to anybody because my head's in the water, and I don't have to get distracted, and you just grind away at that. And that's where a lot of this stuff kind of evolved from. So in a way, while I didn't manage it maybe as well as I would now, it did come around over time.
That's, yeah. So if you fail in an adventure challenge, are you okay with that? Like, as in, are you a miserable sad, as you said, for 2 weeks, or are you going, well, do you know what? I gave it everything and didn't work out, you know?
Yeah. I think.
Hey, we actually, get Sarah Jane in this one. We'll ask her what you're like.
Yeah. She'll give you the honest opinion. If the Irish Sea paddle had worked out the first time, I wouldn't have a clear-cut answer for you. But I think the failure points are kind of different. So if I have a rescue boat fail on me on the way over, that means that I can't do it. That in some ways is very difficult to stomach because it was something you had no control over. But similarly, you can stomach it because it was something that you couldn't have controlled. So bit of a funny one. I think if I was in the middle of a paddle, and you end up getting injured or something, you'd just be disgusted to get that far. But I think when you get to the point where like you're planning everything, if something fails because you haven't planned something correctly, I think I find that very difficult to stomach. If I failed because I had absolutely buried myself beyond belief and I just had nothing else, I think you, well, disappointed, you'd be forced to accept it. So I think I would probably say that I would be a sore loser, but the degree of soreness would depend on
the reason,
the circumstance.
Yeah. Because it's going to be an interesting one as you teach your kids about that when they grow up, right? And because they're no doubt they have your probably competitive streak as well in certain ways.
Or they're just going to play computer games or something for their whole life.
They'll be on Twitch now. They'll be gamers, making millions on YouTube.
Exactly. Yeah.
What do you want to be, a YouTuber? All right, come on. So what's next for you? Like what's your next goal, your next adventure?
It has taken me a while I find that these things, as I was saying to you about the passion or the drive to kind of pursue something, I need to really bite on something. Like it has to kind of grab me to get fully invested. But once that's there, that'll carry me no end. Like that the RSC carried me for 2 years, no problem. And so after the 32 counties, which I probably didn't suffer as much on that as I would like. Did suffer, but it wasn't as miserable as I was hoping.
What was that experience like?
Joe, it was very interesting because ACL and the IRC is just relentless in that once you start, you're not stopping till you stop.
Yes.
There's
a lot of stop starts in this one then over the weekend.
Yes. So and the pressure in that again, where like, I suppose one thing that's kind of maybe overlooked is that you have people giving up their time from work, family. There might be an event on the weekend you go to this, and people are giving up their time to kind of come along and help you because they're buying into what you're doing. And so there's all that pressure again, if you're planning, you're saying, this doesn't work out, I'm wasting all these guys' time. So with the 32, the logistics were horrendous. Just, I probably threw out the route to drive around the country like 9 or 10 times, different iterations, different spots. And then when we got going, we started like 4:30 in the morning up in the north of Dublin, Balbriggan, and we had a stunning morning, fantastic sunrise, water was relatively calm, but you're swimming like in the dark in waters that you don't know, so it feels a bit sketchy till the light comes up. And by the time we got up north, we got through, I think, 5 or 6 counties, we were like 2.5 hours ahead of time. So I was like, right, I'm actually swimming really well, I'm holding good splits. And then we get to Loch Ney, and I was concerned about a thing called bluegill algae, which can just lead to you being an absolute jock. And there'd been stories about it. It affects dogs very badly. I think there'd been a couple of dogs killed in Fermanagh from it only a couple of weeks before. So I knew there was a chance of that happening. Hadn't been able to find anything out about it. And we got up to, obviously, Loch Ney, when you get to it, an incredible expanse of water. It looks like you're beside the sea. We got swimming in a place called Barton's Bay, and I got about 200 meters in, and all of a sudden the water got very murky and a bit discolored, and I was thinking, I am in trouble here. But 200 meters in, if I swim back there, it's 400 meters. The likelihood of me catching something is probably as severe if I just get the 500 meter out and back done. So again, you're making these split decisions in your head on your own terms. So you get that done, and the swim just turns into an exercise of making sure no water gets in your mouth, which is a little bit more tricky than you might think.
Yeah.
And then when we get back to the shore, I'm shouting at one of the lads, Connor, who came along for the drive, just get me a can of Coke now and neck that, because the sugar in it kind of helps kill a lot of bacteria. So we get over that bit, and it's like, oh, well, the lake's that big, we might be okay. We get to the far side of the lake, up to the Derry and the Tyrone side, signs up, blue green algae, do not swim, and like aqua green. And there's uproar up there at the moment, rightly so, it's not in a good way. And so all of a sudden, our 2.5 hour time that we had saved, we were scrambling to find
another piece of water,
other locations.
Okay. Yeah.
And we end up out in a quarry, which was quite a quick fix that worked quite well in kind of an adventure park. And then we end up in the Tyrone Hills, up in a place called Gorchie and Glen Lakes, which if they ever get a chance to go, fantastic. We lose all that time. We get back in the road, and talking to the lads, they're always saying, oh, like, you weren't suffering at all during this. And I'm saying, no, it was like, I was, but not in a way, like physically and fitness wise, I was okay. But trying to get to grips with staying on top of the logistics and understanding the ramifications of what was going on. Because whatever went on, I had to tell the guys what the call was. They weren't making that call. So, like, all the way up until County 30, you're thinking, you're pushing to get this plan over the line and keep it on track. So not only are you the person taking part in the challenge, you're also conducting it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But fantastic crew. The lads were brilliant. And
what was your most impressive county?
The Gorchie and Glen Lakes were very cool now. And because they weren't on the cards, it made it just, I suppose, all that more impressive. Then in Waterford, very cool spot. Yall, and then a place, I think it was Helvick Harbour, I think, if I remember, right over in Waterford. But you know what? It's all, like, it's stunning. And I don't know, maybe it's just me. I think it's amazing that every county in the country has a body of water that you can swim a kilometer in.
Well, Well, this is actually something I wanted to touch on as well, because you're such a big advocate of encouraging people to swim, and you coach it and train it and the like. What would be your message to those who are maybe unsure about what to do to stay mentally or physically active? Like, what would you say water can do to maybe stem the tide, excuse the pun, of their thinking, you know?
For me, I think the water is just a fantastic medium. I always think it's interesting that for the most part, the activities that people engage in are land-based, and you don't have to worry about fighting through something. Whereas when you're in the water, you're fighting against someone that's kind of actively resisting. And I think the process of learning to swim or swimming well or competing, when you get into that kind of rhythm and flow, it feels so smooth. And even though you might be putting yourself under pressure, there's something very relaxing about being in the water. And look, I think we're seeing that exploding as a culture across the country. I think as a nation, we're an island nation surrounded by water, very rich fishing heritage. Like, we have our own unique styles of boats, like curraghs and Galway Bay hookers. But I think over the last maybe 20, 30 years, there might have been a bit of a diversion away from the sea. I think a lot of the coastal stuff, I'm sure everybody remembers more stories about someone saying, "Oh, I wouldn't swim there, that's a wicked stretch of water," as opposed to someone saying, "Go talk to someone and find out and see if it's safe to get in." And I think now we're getting to a point where people are kind of in the water, they're enjoying it, they're seeing the benefits of it. And look, while I can't say that I would have any knowledge or background in knowing how the water would kind of helps people along the cold water immersion and all that, you see people benefiting from it hugely. And I think that can be anything from a dip to swimming 10Ks to channel crossings. And I think it's just finding your sweet spot. What are you interested in doing? Is it just getting involved in kind of dipping in the water? Do you want to be able to swim a kilometer? Do you want to race triathlon? And if you can find your niche, I think then it's easier to pursue an avenue.
I must say, I am such an advocate of the cold water and swimming in the, like, we're so living in Dublin here, we're kind of spoiled for choice a little bit, where you've got 40 foot Vico Bats, you know, all around there, even heading up the north side as well. There's so many beautiful spots there. But I found that COVID was a massive catalyst for me to do that and to get into the water, because we were so limited in what we could do. And for me, what I find with water and after, so I used to get up in the morning, do the sunrise swims out to the boys and back. My friend, his wife Sarah, we used to swim out to the boys and back, and she was like a dolphin. She'd be gone and I'd be trying to catch up with her. But I always found that the people around the area where you're swimming, they're so open and welcoming, and the community feel down there is unreal. Like, one lady who had been swimming there for years and years and years, she saw me get into the water, and I was like super tense in my neck, right? And she was like, "You just need to relax." She says, "The quicker you relax, the quicker your body will adapt to the cold." So I started to relax, and then I went and did a Wim Hof method down in Liscannor in the Clissamore retreat down there, learning how to breathe and manage the cold, and did it with Breathe with Niall O'Verku, who's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And got to understand the benefits of cold water immersion, the benefits of, like, it's not about overdoing it and disrespecting the coldness. It's about getting into it to a point where you're calm and you're kind of in a bit of a peaceful state. That's when you come out. But for me, I just found the mental benefits of it brilliant. I didn't know the psychological and physical, or the physiological benefits, until I went to the Wim Hof thing. But the mental benefits are just, for me, there's such a buzz, and it's so good for me personally, right? But I think with to your point about finding your sweet spot, you found your sweet spot with water when you were young. You went off and played rugby, but then you've come back to water and you found an even newer sweet spot because of your experiences that you had going around traveling the world and getting other cultures and views and stuff. And now you brought it back to Ireland. It's remarkable.
And And so I think a lot of what we're talking about there, there's a lot of detail to it, and there's a lot of depth behind the benefits of being in the water, and there's a lot of science and research behind it. And I think on the other hand, when you look at it, I think the reason why people enjoy it in some ways can be so simple, in that when you get into the water, you can't have your phone on you. You can't have a laptop. Once your head is down, you can't talk, and you have to concentrate on your bit of breathing. So all of a sudden, you're moving from an environment that facilitates distraction to an environment where you can't be distracted, because you have to make sure you're thinking about what way you're going to breathe, how you're managing the cold, even watching maybe the swell or the wind or what way that's working around you. So I think there's maybe something that's a little bit more primal about literally being in a pair of shorts or togs.
You're right. Spotting the seals coming up to see if they're going to come at you or not, or try and mate you.
Exactly.
Tell me this. So I kind of ask everybody this, and I'd love to get your take on it, because you have been through so many challenges. What has been your greatest challenge in life to date?
Oh, none of those. Being a dad.
Really?
But not in a negative way.
Like an opportunity, really.
Look, those, if you're looking at just kind of like the physical side of things, like I'd have loads of stories, like Ironman Lanzarote, I remember bursting a tube and the tire getting sliced open, and I couldn't walk because for some reason my foot blew up on the bike at 90K in. And for the last 40K of the bike, I had to line a tire with power bar wrappers and pump the tube up into it. And then when I got off the bike, my foot was that bad, I couldn't put any pressure on it. But I said, right, get moving or forget it. And I got through it. And I would say that I remember that one, because I know a lot of people said to me afterwards, if that was me, my race was over.
Yeah.
I was like, but you found a way out of it. So then the likes of the IRC, just kind of reaching those kind of really dark places is tough going. But in terms of kind of overall life, I suppose while you mark it as a challenge, they're incredibly fulfilling. And so if it is being a parent or taking these things on, I think the opportunity to allow yourself to take on something that you're not sure that you can do, and if you fail, find out why so you can try it again. Or if you succeed, realizing that you have the capacity to do it in the first place. So I think there's so many of these things. I think a lot of these things can be made quite complicated.
Yeah.
But when it boils down to it, set something out in front of you. If you have the determination and drive to see it through, then you're providing yourself with the opportunity to succeed or fail and learn from it. So I've kind of skirted around your question there a little bit.
No. Because to be honest, I love the honesty as well, that the fact that you said being a dad, because like some people say it's the best thing in the world, and it is, I'm sure, right? And we're not lucky enough yet, but like. But to be honest, but a mate of mine said to me before, if anybody tells you it's easy to be a parent, tell them to fuck off. He says, because they're lying. Yeah. And then he said, and he said, secondly, if anybody tells you to or how to do it, how to be a parent, tell them the same thing. Because he said everybody's different, and I love that honesty, because I'm sure there's people listening going, yeah, do you know what, it is tough, but it is super fulfilling and rewarding, as you said.
It's unbelievable. Look, you can make all the generic comments in the world, everybody knows, changes your life.
Yeah.
Very challenging. But the reward that you get from it, that you have these little people that you're shaping. And I suppose in some ways as well, it's very humbling that you can go and do a challenge like that, right? And I remember after the IRC crossing, I got into bed at half 11, 12 o'clock at night. And even with my eyes closed, I was still swaying. Like I was on the water.
You had the sea legs. Still, okay.
Yeah. I couldn't sleep. I was in that much pain. And I came down like 5 in the morning. I was lying on the sitting room floor trying to stretch things out, ease things out. And when I got up like properly the next morning, and my son Dylan was up, I can't even lift my child up. So Sarah Jane was saying, it's like, just relax today. I was like, no, I was like, I'm going to work, because if I stay here, I can't even hang out with him properly. So like, I prefer to go into work and type, because I don't have to lift my arms a whole lot, than stay here and know that I can't kind of commit to playing with him properly. And I think I suppose the challenge in it is that I don't necessarily think it's to do with kind of raising the children, which is obviously quite tough, but it's just kind of learning curve. I think it's acknowledging that really your life just becomes second place to what they're doing, because you start prioritizing what they're at, and you're thinking, okay, I'd love to go training now, but I need to do this, this, and this. They need to go to bed, I have to get lunches ready for tomorrow. And so it's trying to navigate
back into that routine again. Because like, they don't care that you crossed the channel. They don't care that you did the Irish thing. They're like, Dad, where's my bag? Or you should give me some food.
all he wants to do is get up and play with Diggers. Dylan is my son and Iski is my daughter, and all they want to do is go chasing or whatever. So yeah, if you've had a heavy training session, does not matter. So it's that challenge of making sure that you're trying to look after things at home, make sure that Sarah Jane gets time out, because she's a very hectic schedule, that you get time out, but still having a kind of happy, healthy family life has been a challenge, but fantastic.
So. One more question for you before you go. So you have a billboard, 48 sheet, massive big outdoor piece that we see with all the brands take over, right? You typically have 3 seconds to actually get a message across to anybody who's driving past that. Your message to the world, what would it be?
Go for it. Nice. I think the Irish psyche in a lot of way doesn't do people any favors, because a lot of the time if you present an idea to someone and say, I'm thinking about doing this, I would say 9 times out of 10, even if people are joking, they say, Asha, why would you do that? Or that sounds like a lot of effort. I'm very fortunate that both with my family, my brother and 2 sisters, my mum and dad, Sarah Jane and kids, that, and even with her family, that I live in an environment where if I bring an idea forward, most of the time people say, that sounds interesting, because they know I'm probably going to go for it anyway, but they encourage me. And Sarah Jane makes time for me to go train, and she backs me and encourages me to take it on like that. My dad steps up and helps me out with these things, and people are always very encouraging. And I think there's so many people get caught up in what other people think about what they're doing. If you have a passion and a drive to try and see something through, even if it's like you said, running 5K, 10K, cycling, traveling, whatever it is, if you have an itch, get after it and give yourself the opportunity to succeed, as opposed to failing to ever give it a crack. And I just think people need to be more encouraging of each other, and like that, have that's with that premise in your head, just go for it, try it, see if it works, tweak it, change it, and keep hammering.
Lovely. So Damien, tell me, how can people reach out to you if they wanted to get in touch? I'll put it into the show notes, but just so that they can hear from yourself.
I've been recently coaxed into social media as a part of all this stuff, which I wouldn't be a huge fan of, but I'm now conducting swim coaching and open water swim coaching, and we have our kind of track the challenges on there as well. So if people are interested in getting in touch, even asking a question or asking about anything we've spoken about or just getting in the water, they can follow us. It's at Flow State Swimming on Instagram or flowstateswimming.ie, and look, people have questions or queries, more than happy to help out. As you said, big advocate for people to get in the water, and if I can kind of encourage people in the right direction, be more than happy to help out.
I think your message is unreal. I think there's something you said earlier on, but it's like the art of suffering. And I said, like, there's something in that you definitely become a stronger human as a result of putting yourself through these challenges. And I've noticed it in various conversations that I've been having with people, is that those, when you do that, something better comes out of you as a result. So when you're really, really dark, you get to know yourself that little bit more, so that you can be a better person behind the scenes then with your family, friends and whatnot. And you've got that kind of growth mindset, you know. But Listen, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for taking the time and sharing your story, because I think it's super. And keep doing what you're doing, keep posting, keep actually telling us when your next challenge is, so that I'll put it, and I'll advocate it and get it promoted on our channels. But appreciate everything you've done, and thanks a million for sharing your story. It's been remarkable.
Well, thanks a million for having me, and great to talk about. I'm happy out talking about being in the water, on the water, whatever it is. So, and like that, I think I was probably a little bit naive about whether or not what I was doing was helpful to people. But it's kind of, I suppose, these conversations where I realized that we're all wired differently, and everybody has a slightly different message. And if mine helped one or two people to kind of go pursuing a goal or get after something, then yeah, delighted. It'd be great to help people out.
Brilliant. Well, in your own words, Damien Wiles, go for it.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Once again, thank you for joining me and taking part in this journey where we talk to people like you and me about what motivates them, what inspires them, and ultimately what makes them tick. I've learned so much from the various conversations I've had, and I hope you can take something from this that you can apply to your life. That's why this podcast has been created. I'm very proud of it, and I'm very thankful for everybody who's joined me so far. Thank you all for listening.